Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
Season 6, Episode 3 of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of our new season on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we are talking about the Larry Scott years, 1965 and 1966 Mr. Olympia, the only two Mr. Olympias that Larry Scott won, and these were the very first two Mr. Olympias ever in the history of bodybuilding. So we got some really great history going on. And today we got a great guest, Jerry Branum. Jerry used to work for Iron Man magazine when I was there, but he was there long before I was. And before that, he used to work for Joe Weider's magazine as a writer. And he's a great writer, and he's a great nutritionist also. He knows a lot about nutrition, and he actually has a newsletter out now that we're going to talk about also on their interview. But as some of our other guests that we've already had on this season have told us, such as Dave Mastorakis and Roger Schwab, they were young men back in the mid-60s, and they were at this Mr. Olympia contest. So Jerry wasn't at the very first one in 1965, but he did attend the 1966 Mr. Olympia, which was also held with the Mr. America, the Mr. Universe, and the Mr. World. So Chet Yorton was the winner of the Mr. America that year, and he got beat out the year before by Dave Draper. So in 66, Chet Yorton was the winner. And then the Mr. Universe winner was Dave Draper, and the Mr. World winner was Sergio Oliva. And that was the first time that Sergio Oliva had come over to the IFBB. And then in the Mr. Olympia that year, they had four competitors. They had Larry Scott, Harold Poole, Chuck Sipes, and Sergio Oliva. So Jerry is going to talk about that contest. I believe he was only like 15 years old when he went to the contest to see it. And Jerry lived in Brooklyn, and it was, of course, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Jerry's a great storyteller. He's always got a lot of interesting insights into everybody. So we're going to have a great interview with Jerry Branum. You guys are really going to enjoy this. Speaking of Dave Mastorakis, he was our guest last week. And I mentioned on the show last week that Dave had some pictures from both 65 and 66 because he was in both of those competitions. He went in the Mr. America contest at only 15 and 16 years old. That's amazing. So Dave was actually in the Mr. America on stage with all these legends as a teenager, and he brought his camera with, thank God, and he took some great pictures, and he shared them with us. So we will have them on the BodybuildingLegendsShow.com website. As you know, we have a BodybuildingLegendsShow.com website where I have all my video interviews, and we also have articles on there, and occasionally we'll have pictures, because when we did our interview with Gary Bartlett a couple months ago, and we were talking about the 1981 Mr. Olympia, Gary had some great pictures from that contest that he never published before. They were never in a magazine. So he shared them with us, and we put them on the website. So you can check those out, too, if you go check out Dave's pictures. So it's really, really cool pictures, backstage stuff of Dave Draper and Chuck Sipes and Chet Yorton, Frank Zane, Rock Stonewall, Sergio. Really, really cool stuff. Totally candid shots. Now, before we go any further, though, I do want to mention that we are brought to you again by Redcon One. Everyone wants to be a champion. Everybody wants to be the best. And at Redcon One, they believe in working hard to achieve your goals. Whether you're killing it in the gym or running a six-minute mile, Redcon One has something for those willing to put in the work. They have a premier clinically dosed pre-workout called Total War that is the perfect companion to your workout to give you that extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. And then you can fuel your body after those workouts with the revolutionary MRE. This is the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein coming from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs, and carb sources coming from sweet potatoes and oats. And it also contains 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. This is the best tasting complete meal you will ever have. And they also have the new MRE bars now available on Redcon One. So go to redcon1.com. and try the very best that sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon One, the highest state of readiness. And you can enter the discount code LEGENDS and get 15% discount off your order just because you listen to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And we're also brought to you by Old School Labs. With so many supplements on the market, it can be hard to know which brand is the right one. As a three-time Natural Mr. Universe and Natural Mr. Olympia winner, the quality of supplements that knowing what I'm taking is very important to me. which is why Old School Labs is giving you 12% off your purchase. So if you just go to oldschoollabs.com, use the code LEGEND12 at the checkout, they will know that you listen to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and you will get 12% off your order. And be sure to check out also their Vintage Brawn Protein. This is a protein that is made from whole food sources such as eggs, milk, and beef. So check that out. I take that every day. I love it. So go to oldschoollabs.com and order some supplements from them. Thank you to Redcon One and Old School Labs for continuing to sponsor our Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, my book is now available on Amazon. I know I've been talking about it for weeks, but it did become available this week on Amazon. I got that proof of the book last week, and I approved it this week. So it is now available on Amazon.com. So go check that out. It's called Diary of a Natural Bodybuilder, and it will tell you everything you need to know as a natural bodybuilder, how to diet down and get ripped and keep your muscle. The first part of the book, I detail the exact training and diet principles that I used to get ready for all the natural contests I competed from 1991 to 1998. And 1998 was when I won the Natural Olympia competition. That was probably my peak. So I have all my diets in there, all my training. I keep track of everything, my measurements, and I detail exactly what I did for every show. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. There was a couple shows where I came in flat, a couple shows where I was holding water, a couple shows where I really increased my size, like in 1996 when I competed at my heaviest weight. Couple shows where I came in perfect and ripped and everything worked out perfect. So you get to read all of that and read all about the stories, the guys I competed against, the competitions I entered. So it's really interesting. And then the second part of the book tells you how you can do it. This is the type of diet you should follow to get ripped. I talk about the macronutrients, protein, carbs, fat, how many calories you need. Do you need to do cardio? How much cardio should you do? And then I get into the details of contest preparation. Shaving off your body hair, getting tan, doing a posing routine, how to develop your posing routine for your physique, how to do the mandatory poses perfectly, and also what to expect on the day of the contest. What's the prejudging going to be like? What should you do in between the prejudging and night show? What should you do at the night show? How to do a pose down? What's going to happen at a pose down? So all that stuff is in there. It's really, really a cool book. And I want to thank all the people that purchased it this week so far on Amazon.com. And if you want to get a free copy of my book, I am offering a free copy to anybody who purchases a training or diet program from me. And this special will go on for the next month. So if you're interested in getting a new training program for yourself, or you want to reach your goals as far as your diet, and you're not able to do it yourself, you can't figure it out, you need some expert advice, then go to my website, which is called dadbod2ripbod.com. That's dadbod2ripbod.com, and just you can fill out the questionnaire there and order it there. And every order I get from now until the end of May, I will send you a free copy of my Diary for a Natural Bodybuilder. So take advantage of that offer. And my diet is still continuing. I'm down to a 35-inch waist now, so I'm 3 inches down from when I started, because my waist was 38, believe it or not, when I started the new year. So I'm hoping to get down to 33. 33 for me is ripped. So if I get down to 33, I should be ripped, and I should be there this summer around July. So looking forward to that. I'll get some photo shoots taken. We did have some interesting interviews this week. We had Porter Cottrell, who was one of the top pro bodybuilders in the 1990s. Porter won his pro card at the 1991 Nationals. That was the same Nationals that Kevin Lebroney won and got his pro card, but could get your pro card if you win your class. So Porter won the light heavyweight class. Kevin won the heavyweight class. And it was really close. People forget that, but it was really close between those two for the overall. I think Kevin only beat him by one or two votes, and Kevin looked amazing that year. And what's even more interesting is when Porter began his pro career, which was the very next year in 1992, he beat Kevin at the very first. Well, he won the Niagara Falls Pro Show in 92, and then he beat Kevin at the Chicago Pro Show, which I was actually at because I lived in Chicago at the time. And then the week later, Kevin won the Night of the Champions, and Porter took second. But Porter had a great career as a pro bodybuilder. He won the Night of the Champions the next year, beating out Andreas Munzer. And we also talk about his experience with Momo Benaziza, because he was there the night Momo Benaziza died after taking too many diuretics after the 92 Mr. Olympia. It was actually in the Grand Prix shows the week after the Mr. Olympia in 92. So Porter was there. Porter was a firefighter at the time, and he tried to give CPR to save Momo, and he couldn't. So he talks about all that and then his decision to retire from bodybuilding. So we got a really great interview with Porter Cottrell. So that'll be coming up in the next couple of weeks when we get done with this season about the Larry Scott years of the 1965 and 66 Mr. Olympia. And then next week, I'm going to be talking to Vic Downs. And Vic was a bodybuilder who competed in the 1960s. He was actually in the 1966 Mr. World contest where Sergio Oliva won. So he was part of the competitions that we're talking about. And Vic is from Canada. He actually started bodybuilding a little bit late. In fact, Jerry Branum mentions him in our interview today when we talked to him. And I think he said Vic Downs started bodybuilding in his 30s or late 30s and competed until his 40s. But Vic was also in the 1967 Mr. Universe that Sergio won. And he was, as I said, he was in the Mr. World contest that Sergio won. And he also competed in the NABBA contest a few times. So Vic is now in his 90s. And I talked to him the other day and he sounds great. So we're going to talk to Vic next week and we'll have that interview up for you soon also on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. What else is going on? Oh, we got the new Avengers movie. It came out yesterday. So I went and saw it. And it was really good. I really liked it. When I was a kid, I used to read comic books. So it's really cool now to see Marvel being transferred to the screen. And it's amazing the stuff they can do with the CGI and the special effects. So if you're an old comic book reader like I was, it's pretty cool to see all your superhero comic book heroes come to life now in these movies. And this was an amazing movie. I think this was the 19th movie that Marvel Comics has done since they started with Iron Man in 2008. And they've developed their own little Marvel universe. And everybody lives in the same world. And so they all interact with each other. So it was really cool seeing some of the new characters from Marvel, like the Guardians of the Galaxy and Spider-Man. They got to interact with the old Avengers like Thor and Captain America and Iron Man. And I know Dave Bautista. He trains at my gym out here in Tampa, the Powerhouse Athletic Club. So it was cool seeing Dave Bautista on the screen. And he had some of the funniest lines in the movie playing Drax from Guardians of the Galaxy. So that was really, really cool to see Dave doing that. So congratulations to him on another great role. I think he's got another movie coming out with Jodie Foster next month. And Jodie Foster directed it. And that one looks really good, too. So Dave's got a great, great movie career going. So congratulations to him. He's such a great guy. So check that out if you get a chance this weekend. Crowds are out. I went to a show at 11 o'clock at night, and the movie is so long. It's over 2 hours long. I didn't get out of the theater until, well, they showed previews for a half hour, so it didn't even start till 11:30. And then by the time I got out of the theater, it was almost 2 in the morning, and they had another show going on 2 in the morning. People were actually going to the movies at 2 o'clock in the morning, so it's crazy the fan base they have for these Marvel comics. But it's definitely worth seeing. I thought it was a great movie, real exciting and real fun. And they had a great villain with Josh Brolin playing the villain Thanos. And this was like the problem they have with these superhero movies is these guys are so powerful. Who can they fight? With this guy Thanos is like the most powerful guy in the whole universe. So he's kicking ass for everybody. Even the Hulk got his ass kicked from Thanos. So it's really a great movie because in order to have a good movie like this, you got to have a good villain. Same thing with the James Bond movies. You always got to have a good villain. The best James Bond movies were the ones where they had the best villains. And this one has a great villain with Josh Brolin playing Thanos. So it's really a great movie. So check that out. All right. I also do want to mention we're brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing they're there for you every step of the way. They offer very competitive pricing along with their quality products and services. So give them a call for more information and experience firsthand what sets them apart from the rest. I've referred a lot of my friends to Florida Alternative Medicine, and they've really given me great positive reviews from them. So give them a call. Their office number in Tampa is 813-922-8939, but you don't have to be in Florida to talk to them. You can talk to them anywhere in the United States. They will service you anywhere. And if you want to go to their website for more information, go to flalternativemeds.com. And if you do talk to them on their website or call them, tell them that you heard about Florida Alternative Medicine from the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation. Plus, they will give you 20% off your first order, which is a great deal. So again, their office number is 813-922-8939, or visit their website at flalternativemeds.com. All right, so that is it for our opening. And now here is our interview with Jerry Branum talking about the 1966 Mr. Olympia contest. Enjoy. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my very special guest is always one of my favorite guests. We've had him on my other shows before. Jerry was a writer for Joe Weider for many years, and then he was a writer for Iron Man magazine. And now he has his own newsletter at appliedmetabolics.com, which is a great newsletter that comes out every month. So Jerry's here to talk about the 1966 Mr. Olympia contest. So welcome to the podcast, Jerry. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, John. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Well, let's talk about this contest, Jerry. We were just doing a little pre-interview, and you said you were only 16 years old and you were living in Brooklyn when they had this contest at the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and as I said, I was very excited to see this contest because, like most teenage bodybuilders at the time, and I'm sure you did this too, we didn't have the internet, and there was not even a dream of an internet back then, and everything we knew about bodybuilding was from the magazines, and I looked at all these bodybuilding stars, and, you know, this was an opportunity to see them in person. I was extremely excited, and the, you know, the California, the West Coast bodybuilders had an aura of almost, the only way I could describe it, they were almost like movie stars to East Coast bodybuilders. I mean, we had this idea that everybody out there, you know, trained and, you know, ran down the beach in the sun and hung out with beautiful bikini girls. I mean, living the life. I mean, you know, this probably was well, having lived out here for years, it was a sort of a fantasy. I mean, it wasn't that simple. But still, that's the way we looked on these guys. So it was a very exciting thing for me to attend this contest.
Yeah, I just did an interview with Roger Schwab, and that's what we were talking about, how Joe Weider built up this image for the young kids, you know, kids like yourself and myself when we were young, and we used to see these guys like Dave Draper and Larry Scott on the beach with the surfboard and, you know, beautiful Betty Weider in their arms, and
right.
We thought they'd be live like that every day, right?
Right, but I remember when I started to actually work for Joe regularly in the early 80s, I remember him telling me how the genesis of the Mr. Olympia came about. He was telling me how, you know, you had all these bodybuilders that won major titles, Mr. America, Miss Universe, and, you know, they had nowhere to go after that. I mean, you know, he said there should be a professional show that basically anoints somebody the king of bodybuilders. And you'll see how this relates to this particular Mr. Olympia we're talking about in a couple of minutes. But he basically described Mr. Olympia as the king of bodybuilders. And he says the Olympia was kind of a takeoff on two things. On the Olympic Games itself, you know, because, you know, the Weider brothers always had this dream of getting bodybuilding into the Olympics.
Right.
And the other thing was that it was kind of a reference to Mount Olympia, you know, which, if you look at the Greek legends, this is the home of the gods.
In other words,
these bodybuilders who compete in the Mr. Olympia were literally spectral figures. They were the gods of bodybuilding. That's the way Joe looked at it. So I knew about it. And so he established, of course, the first Mr. Olympia was 1965. I didn't attend that one. And, you know, that of course, also was won by Larry Scott. But that was an interesting thing. I mean, later on, Joe, you know, took me in his, I was again in his office, and he gave me a similar dialogue because he said, you know, we have to do something about these older bodybuilders. I said, what do you mean? He said, Joe, he says, you know, these guys who are over 40, a lot of them are still in fantastic shape. You know, they might have won their major titles 10, 15 years earlier. I think we should have a contest for them. And that was the genesis of the Masters Mr. Olympia.
Oh, okay.
Which sadly, I don't, maybe you could correct me on this, John. I don't think it exists anymore, the Masters Mr. Olympia, as far as I know.
No, they haven't run that for a few years now.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm not sure why it didn't become more popular, but I think a lot of it might have had to do with the fact that people have a certain image of these bodybuilders in their prime, you know, when they're in their 20s and 30s. And let's face it, nobody escapes the aging process, you know. And when you start to hit your late 40s, early 50s, you could still look in fantastic shape, don't get me wrong, but it's not quite the way you looked, let's say, at your peak in your 20s. And I think a lot of people just were a little bit turned off by that. So I think that's what probably accounts for the lack of popularity of the Masters Mr. Olympia, I should say.
Yeah, I remember Bill Pearl had a famous quote. He said, bodybuilding is a young man's game. And I think he did his last show at 41, which back then was kind of old, you know. But yeah, he said he said I'll never take my shirt off after a certain age, you know. I'll never take my shirt off in public, you know.
I heard that too. I mean, there's inevitable changes that, you know, there's nothing, no matter what you do, I mean, you could do everything right, and there's still going to be some changes. And, you know, you can see that with a good example was Kevin Livroni when he made his comeback in the Mr. Olympia. What was it, like 2 years ago or something like that? I mean, Kevin, I think you'll probably agree, I look at him as one of the uncrowned Mr. Olympians. If absolutely. Mm-hmm. When he was younger, he was a sight to behold, a fantastic bodybuilder.
Yeah.
You know, he came back, and kudos to him for getting in that kind of shape at 52. He went from, like, no physique at all for a couple of years, where he basically looked like he quit training to go into acting and, you know, play music and all that. Then he decided to go back in bodybuilding. He trained for, a year or so for the...
Yeah.
He looked, again, exceptional for a 52-year-old man. But he just wasn't the same Kevin Livrone as we saw when he was in his 20s, especially his legs, you know. And I actually had a phone conversation with Kevin about 3 or 4 weeks after that Olympia. I wasn't aware of the fact that Kevin suffered a knee injury while preparing for that Olympia, and he couldn't train his legs for the last 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I did a video about that Olympia, I kind of mentioned that, you know, Kevin's an example of what happens to older bodybuilders, because, you know, there's an old saying, the legs go first.
Yeah.
And I've noticed this over and over again. You see some of the great bodybuilders in history, their legs just can't seem to keep up. They kind of dissipate. And, you know, they just came out with a study in one of the science journals basically explaining the cause. It has to do with what they call motor neurons. Motor neurons are what stimulate muscle to basically keep their size. And when you get past, let's say 45, 50 years old, you get 30 to 60% less motor neuron stimulation in the legs.
Hmm.
In the legs. So, in other words, no matter how hard you train, this is what it means, you're not going to get the legs you had when you were younger. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
So, you know, although, of course, you know, Kevin not being able to train his legs at all, that added to the effect, you know, of what happened to him.
Did you see the pictures of him just from a couple of weeks ago? He was in that Arnold Classic that was in Australia, I believe. It was like 2 weeks after the Arnold Classic in Columbus. Yeah, he competed again.
Did he? You know, I wasn't aware of that. Did he place?
No, he was like last.
Oh, my God.
He was much bigger than he looked at the Olympia, and his legs looked much bigger. It just wasn't the same physique. You know, it almost looks like the arms and the legs even look like they just didn't have the same shape. It's weird. I mean, he was much bigger. I mean, maybe weight-wise, he was almost the same, but it just didn't look the same, you know?
You see, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, you know, even a guy with his genetics, I mean, this is a guy with, we all know the old adage that bodybuilding, to a large degree, is based on genetics.
Yeah.
In other words, you could do everything right, but, you know, unless you have these superior genetics, it's very hard to get to the top echelon, the elite level of bodybuilding, unless you have a certain type of genetic body. And, you know, Kevin had that body. He was a genetic freak, and I mean that in a positive way. But even a guy like Kevin or Flex Wheeler, when he made his comeback, I mean, you can't battle Father Time, unfortunately. It's a losing battle.
I know.
You know, the best you could hope for, and this is what I do myself, of course, I'm not on these guys' level at all. But, you know, but the point is, all you can do is try and stay in the best shape you can for yourself.
Yeah.
Because I'm not comparing myself to these guys. I don't have anything close to the genetics. In fact, I don't even have good genetics for bodybuilding, to tell you the truth. But the point is that I continue to work out today to just stay healthy, maintain the muscle I do have, and that's the best you can hope for. You know, you can't expect to look at, you know, in your 50s and 60s as you did in your 20s and 30s. That would be very disappointing for anyone to try that. Because, again, you're battling human physiology. It's not going to happen. In the future, I will tell you this, that's the bad news. The good news is I can tell you right now, they're already working on this. In the future, they'll be able to kind of like build up stem cells and muscle. They'll be able to let's say, resurrect what they call satellite cells, which are involved in muscle hypertrophy. You know, they've already done this in animals where, you know, you'll get a guy who's like, let's say, Kevin Livroni. He's, 53 now, 54, I'm not sure how old, 54, let's say.
Yeah.
Where you can, you know, where he can undergo this therapy, and believe it or not, he will look like he did in his 20s. He will look that, even in his legs, he'll look that good. But that's a little further up the line, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, but it's something that will be very interesting to see in the future.
When do you think that'll be happening, Jerry?
I would say in about at least 15, maybe 20 years, it'll be perfected.
Wow.
Right now they're doing stem cell therapy for, let's say, you know, joint degeneration, all that. But between, you know, the truth of the matter is I looked into this, and it's not really perfected yet. I mean, people are all raving. They go to Europe to have this stem cell. Mm-hmm. It's not perfected yet. I mean, it's kind of like a not ready for prime time type of thing. A lot of people are going to be, in fact, I know a couple of people that underwent stem cell therapy, for example, knee arthritis. And again, you know, they didn't get the results they wanted. They wound up getting a knee replacement anyway. It just didn't take.
Hmm.
But it will in the future. I have no doubt. They just have to work out the kinks, so to speak.
I'll be 75 in 20 years, so maybe I can make a comeback.
Oh, I'm telling you, John, you know, just think about it. At 75, you'll have the body you had when you were 35.
Amazing. Wow. With that and Viagra, I'll be doing good, huh?
Oh, you'll be doing great, sure. Right.
Let's go back in time here, Jerry, and go back to 1966. As you mentioned, they had several other contests, which youngsters today may find that pretty weird because we think of the Mr. Olympia as such a big event that they hold on its own. But back in 1966, which was the second year they had the show, they had the Mr. America, the Mr. World, and the Mr. Universe all with the Mr. Olympia, and then the Mr. Olympia kind of finished off the night.
Right.
So they had some great bodybuilders on stage before we got to the Mr. Olympia. So let's talk about that in addition to the Mr. Olympia. So the Mr. America that year, that was won by Chet Yorton, and the year before that,
exactly
he took
right.
second to Dave Draper the year before. So he came back and he won the Mr. America in 1966. And this was also, I think, the year that Chet went over to London and competed in the NABBA Mr. Universe, and he beat Arnold, the 19-year-old Arnold Schwarzenegger at the Mr. Universe.
That's true. That's very true. And I remember, I wasn't at the NABBA Universe. I was in London. But I remember reading in the magazines, they said that the reason that Chet, you know, Chet wasn't as big as Arnold. Even Arnold was, what, 19, 20 years old? 19 years old. And, you know, but the reason that Chet won was he had a more finished physique. In other words, he came in with a tan. Arnold was kind of pale and, you know, mm-hmm. he was big but smooth. But the chief reason why they give for Chet's victory over that young Arnold was his calves.
Right.
In other words, Chet had good calves. I remember he had very good calves, you know, and he beat Arnold on that basis. And, of course, this put a seed in Arnold's brain about, you know, I need to get my calves up. And, you know, that would became his focus for the next, let's say, 3 or 4 years after that.
Yeah.
You know, the story is that he went to his mentor and his idol, Reg Park, who, of course, also won the NABBA Universe at least 4 times, if I recall. And, you know, Reg asked Arnold, how much weight do you do on calf raises? And Arnold said, well, I think about 300 pounds. And Reg said, well, you need to be using 1,000 pounds. That's the story. I don't know if it's
right.
true. You know,
right, I heard that story, too.
But I do remember, there's one thing I can tell you about Arnold, since I witnessed him. I actually trained with him many times, and I did witness him. The one muscle that he always paid attention to was his calves. Even during the off season, when he'd hardly trained the rest of his body, he would still do a full calf workout. It's like he worked so hard to get those calves that he didn't want to lose them.
Yeah,
you know, so he kept training them.
Right.
You know, so Chet Yorton won, and Chet was I remember being a deserving winner. I don't quite recall who his main competitors. Maybe you could tell me who his other competitors were in that America.
Yeah, I got the list right here. Rock Stonewall won the
Rock
short
Stonewall
mess.
Show. Okay. Rock Stonewall I knew. His real name was Jesse.
An
interesting thing about Rock Stonewall is his sister, maybe at that time, I'm not sure at that time, but was married to another famous bodybuilder named Leroy Colbert.
Leroy was famous for his
having one of the first guys to have like 21-inch arms.
Mm-hmm.
And Leroy ran a health food store up in Upper Manhattan, right around that time. And Rock Stonewall's sister, he was married to, they worked together. I used to go up and visit Leroy at the store, and I used to talk to his Rock's sister all the time. But Rock Stonewall, his sister's name, I mean, she told me his real name was Jesse, if I remember correctly.
Yeah,
and,
you're right.
Unfortunately, I don't know, maybe you do, John, because you're pretty good at the history of bodybuilding. Rock Stonewall died at a young age, and I'm not sure what his cause of death was.
No, I don't know either. I know he was from Chicago, which is my hometown.
Yeah, he was a very impressive bodybodybuilder, very impressive, very impressive.
Yeah,
in other words, and this is another case of where Chet beat him because of Chet's superior leg development. The same thing that happened with Arnold. Rock Stonewall had a comparable upper body, but Chet had the legs over him. That's why Chet beat him.
And then Frank Zane won the medium class.
Oh, yeah, Frank Zane. In fact, let me see, was it that same year? It was either that year or the year before is where I met Frank Zane, because I competed in a contest also held at the Brooklyn Academy. It was called the Mr. Eastern American, Teenage Eastern America. I was in the Teenage Eastern America, and Frank Zane, who was unknown in bodybuilding at that time, nobody had ever heard of him. He's still living in Pennsylvania. He was in the Mr. Eastern America.
Okay.
And, you know, in those days when the contest started, everybody would stand on stage and they'd open the curtain, you know, and you just everybody would be on stage. In fact, you could see photos of the America that year that we're talking about. 60. You'll see that when the photos of all of them standing on stage, and when Dave Draper was posing, you'd see all the competitors in the background.
Right.
I was standing next to Frank Zane. And, you know, I don't know if the bodybuilders still do it, but in those days we used to put on baby oil on our bodies to make this idea that it would make us look more defined or something like that. I never really knew the reason for that. But, you know, I was a kid. I was 15 years old, something like that. I put on too much baby oil, so it was literally dripping off me. You know. And Frank Zane was standing next to me, and he says, "You mind if I take some of that oil and put it on me?" so he took off my back and my shoulder, and he put it on himself. and you know, as he's doing this, I'm looking at the guy, and I'm thinking, "Wow, this guy's got a physique." And
really?
I was corresponding with Bill Pearl at the time, you know. And I remember writing Bill Pearl a letter, and I said to Bill Pearl, I said, "Watch out for this guy, Frank Zane. I think he's going to be a top physique." And sure enough, Frank did go on to win, if I remember correctly. He won the Mr. Eastern America that night. I didn't fare as well. I got something like second or third in the teenage event. I didn't win.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. What year was that, Jerry?
That was, I think, 65.
65. Okay, so the year before this then. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I look at pictures of Frank from those years, he had the symmetry. He had the same great physique. He just didn't look as ripped as he was at the Olympia later on, you know?
Right, exactly right. He just wasn't as ripped, but he had the small waist, the small hips.
Yeah.
I mean, and a good poser, I remember. I mean, you know, the early Frank Zane was always an introvert, and I remember trying to engage him in some conversation at that contest, and, you know, he clearly didn't want to talk. It wasn't that he was unfriendly. It's just that he seemed like, you know, he more or less was saying, "I'm focused on, you know, my posing. I'd rather not, you know, get any, you know," and it was one of those things.
I didn't take it
personally. I understood, you know. As I got to know Frank Zane years later, I realized he was basically an introverted personality. You know, he wasn't, you know, wasn't that social in his early years. As he's gotten older, though, he's become much more social. Even to this day, though, he still is kind of mostly introvert. I mean, he has a Facebook page, but he doesn't really participate, that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
So, but that's just his personality. You can't fault him for that, you know.
He's always been sort of the opposite of Arnold.
Exactly. That's right. Right.
And then in the tall class at that Mr. America, we said Chet Yorton was the winner, but he beat Don Howarth, who was another big name.
Don Howarth, oh yeah, Mr. Shoulders, that's right.
Yeah.
Don Howarth was one of the California Golden Boys, too. I mean, he came out of Vince's gym. And, you know, an interesting thing about Don Howarth, of course, Don Howarth, let's see, I believe he won it a year later. You know, he won the America the next year. And I remember, what was it? I was living next door to Frank Zane around 1970. And Frank, you know, he was actually in the very next apartment next to me. And he had some contests coming up where I think he was going to compete against Don Howarth. And he brought in photos of Don Howarth and photos of him, and he asked me, he said, "Who do you think would win between me and Don Howarth?" So I told him, I said, "Frank, I think you would win, and I'll tell you why. You have better legs."
Yeah.
I said, "He, quite honestly, Don, you know, Don has the shoulder width, he has the deltoids on you, and he has the arms on you, but, you know, you have the legs on him, so I think you have better symmetry. I'd give it to you." I meant it. I wasn't saying that just because he was next-door neighbor. You know, that's what I believe. But Don Howarth was a great bodybuilder. I never, you know, I got his autograph at the contest, but I didn't really talk to him until many, many years later when he was inducted into the Muscle Beach Hall of Fame.
Oh yeah.
And I had this conversation with him, and I realized what a nice guy he is.
Yeah.
I mean, he had this kind of self-deprecating humor that was very refreshing. You know, I mean, just a really nice, super nice guy. I didn't know it at the time, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. He trained at Vince's gym, right? He was a big Vince.
Yeah, he was a Vince's gym guy. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, Frank had great legs back then. In fact, I noticed that a lot of these shows, they had body part awards, and he would usually win best legs at most
he
of the
did.
Shows.
Yeah, he did have great legs. That's true. Yep.
I was looking at, they have a list of the judges here, too. This is pretty interesting. Leroy Colbert was one of the judges. You just mentioned him. Ed Jubenville, who, was, of course, is a, used to hold those shows out on the East Coast, right, in Holyoke, Massachusetts.
Yeah, at Holyoke Amusement Center. I competed in two of his shows.
Did you really? Yeah.
Yeah, it was called Mount Holyoke Amusement Park, it was called.
Uh-huh.
It was an outdoor park, and it was outdoor. In fact, you could see a little bit if you watch the movie Pumping Iron.
Yeah.
There's a scene, I think it was Mike Katz guest posing at one of
that
was Ed Jubenville's show.
Right.
And Ed Jubenville was known for his, he would do this kind of muscle contortion and muscle control thing.
Right.
He was able to isolate his lats and do this weird thing with his abdominals. You know, I remember competing in a teenage show in Mount Holyoke, and I remember when I got there, I was looking at the other competitors, and, you know, I was a kid. I was, again, like 15, 16, maybe 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at this guy, you know, across the room. He was about 6'1", and he was literally twice as big as me. And I said, my God, I have to compete. I was like 170 pounds. This guy looked like 220. I said, I got to compete against this guy? Well, the guy's name, it turned out, was a guy named Rick Giafu. I don't know if you remember this guy.
Yeah, he was a famous teenage competitor, yeah.
He wound up coming out to California. Unfortunately, another guy who prematurely died, I don't, again, recall the reason why. I know he fell off a balcony and was paralyzed for a while. I don't know what happened to the poor guy.
Huh.
But, I mean, this guy was so big as a teenager that I knew that I had no chance of winning.
Wow.
Again, I got something like second or third in that show. Another guy in that show who is a good friend of mine today, of course, I'm sure you know Dave Mastorakis.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Dave was tremendous physique. I believe he might have won the short class, and I know he won that contest, if not that year, maybe a year later. Tremendous abdominal. He looked like a little Hercules. I mean, the guy was total head-to-toe body and no weak points. Tremendous. And Dave, again, is just a fantastic, wonderful person.
Was Dave a teenager back then?
Pardon me?
Was Dave a teenager back then?
Yeah. Dave is about the same age as me. Yeah.
He was
a teenager. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw Dave compete at, I went to the 1977 Mr. Olympia in Columbus, Ohio, and I think Dave was in the Mr. International that year.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing him in the magazine, so it was cool to see him in person. But yeah, you're right. Yeah. That's a perfect way to describe him. He looked like a mini Hercules.
Yeah. He was a very close friend of Mike Mensa, too. In fact,
yeah.
Mike got him into the high intensity training, you know, the low volume, very high intensity.
Yeah.
And to this day, you know, Dave still trains that way. I mean, he's been a personal trainer for many, many years, and he trains his clients that way. He still trains high intensity. Still does it after all.
Wow.
He's been doing it. It's got to be over 40 years at least.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mention some of these other judges, Dr. Jules Levine. Remember
Jules
him?
Jules Levine, I trained at his
RJ Health Studio. Yeah.
Yeah, R&J, that was my Brooklyn training. After, I trained in Mid-City Gym in New York for 1 year in the mid-60s. And then when we called him Julie Levine, Julie.
Yeah,
when he opened up the R&J, by the way, the R stood for a guy named Ron Covino. And, of course, the J was for Julian Levine.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Covino was his brother-in-law. And they opened up this gym on Avenue U in Brooklyn. As soon as that happened, instead of taking the subway all the way to Manhattan, I switched my training quarters to R&J. And, of course, that was also the home gym of Lou Ferrigno.
Yeah, that was in Pumping Iron, right? Isn't that
the
one he's walking in front of? Yeah.
That's exactly right. That gym where his father's training him, that is R&J Health Studio. That's
wow. So that was the one where he's doing the clean and press with 225
exactly.
pounds. That's R&J.
That's right.
Wow.
That's the gym, yeah. And I think I met Lou at that gym. When I met Lou, he was a skinny guy with those, you know, those thick glasses people used to
wear. Yeah.
He used to come in with his father, Matty, who's also in Pumping Iron.
Mm-hmm.
And I was training with a guy named Pete Caputo at R&J.
I remember
and,
him.
Lou used to badger us with questions about how to train. I mean, every exercise we did, he wanted to know about. And, you know, I mean, when I saw him 2 years later, when I came into New York, because I moved to California about a year or two after that, but when I came in about a year after that, you know, I came in the gym and I saw this huge guy, and he says, "Hey, Jerry," and I'm looking at him, I'm thinking, who is this guy? Because I had last seen Lou, he was very lean, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm looking at a guy who looked like he was 300 pounds.
Wow.
He says, "It's me, Lou." I said, "Lou, what did you do? How did you get big?" You know? He says, "I've been drinking 6 quarts of milk a day."
Yeah.
I still remember that conversation.
Yeah. You know? Every conversation I have with Lou, you could tell he's a real bodybuilding fan. Like, he loves bodybuilding.
Real, oh, yeah. You
know?
He's
especially
very much
in the old days, you know?
Very much. Oh, he used to talk to me. In fact, when I moved to California, I would come back to visit my parents, and Lou, I'd see Lou, and he would just, he wanted to know everything about the California bodybuilders.
Yeah.
He would ask me questions, and he was like a little kid. He was rapt attention.
Mm-hmm.
He just loved to hear the stories about these guys.
Yeah, despite all his fame and everything he's done and all the contests he's won, he's still like a huge bodybuilding fan.
And by the way, Julie Levine, I should tell you, was a chiropractor. Who I don't know if he ever practiced. I think he just opened the gym. His brother-in-law, Ron Covino, he kind of bowed out. I don't remember why, about 3 months after the gym opened. And Julie wound up running R&J by himself. But Julian Levine was a freakishly strong guy, by the way, who, you know, he could lift like 200. I saw him take 160-pound dumbbells, clean them, and lift them overhead 6 times fairly easily.
Wow.
I mean, he was phenomenally strong. Phenomenally strong.
Huh. I never knew that.
Yeah.
And then Tom Minichiello was one of the other judges.
Tom Minichiello was the owner of Mid-City Gym.
Right.
It was the gym I trained at before R&J.
Okay.
Tom Minichiello got me suspended from junior high school once because what I used to do is I cut a couple of classes in school and jump on the subway and go train at Mid-City. And I would, if you won't believe this, I used to train for 8 straight hours.
Wow.
I would start I'd get there at like about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and train until closing. And they'd have to literally throw me out of the gym. And one day Tom came up to me and he says, "Jerry," he says, you know, because some days I'd get there like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He knew that school, you know, you got out of school at 3.
Yeah.
He says, "Jerry, aren't you supposed to be in school?" So I said, "I have an arrangement with the teachers." I said, "You know, they let me skip a couple of classes," which was only partially true. And he wound up calling the school, and I wound up getting suspended for a week because of that. True story.
That's funny. Yeah. He promoted a couple of Mr. Olympia events, right, in New York?
That's right. Yeah, he did. Yeah, that's true.
And then Franklin Page, he was one of the other judges.
Franklin Page, he was a longtime Ironman rider.
Right, that's what it says.
I remember he was a gray-haired guy. He looked like a college professor or something like that. Yeah.
Chuck Renslow?
Chuck Renslow, I'm not sure who he was. I don't know who
he was. He was an IFBB director for Chicago.
Oh, okay. I'm not really familiar with him.
And then Lud Shusterich?
Lud Shusterich was a bodybuilder in the late 40s, early 50s. Very, very close friend of Joe Weider. Mm-hmm. And Joe Weider made him head of the Weider European operations. In fact, Lud Shusterich should be really given the credit for discovering Arnold.
Yeah, I remember his name in regards to Arnold.
Yeah, pardon me?
I remember when Arnold was coming to America, I remember Lud's name in a lot of the books I read about Arnold.
Right, because Lud is the one who actually told Arnold, although you hear various stories, Lud is the guy who said to Joe Weider, "Joe, you should bring this guy over. He's phenomenal." He's not, you know, because the, you know, at that NABBA universe against Chet Yorton, and he couldn't believe this guy was 19 years old. I mean, to have that kind of muscle size.
Mm-hmm.
So he suggested that Joe bring him over to California. I mean, the way the stories are today, and even Arnold says this, he acts like Joe Weider himself contacted him and brought him over. But the middleman, really, who was kind of forgotten to history, was Lud Shusterich. Because Lud's the one who told Joe to, you know, bring Arnold, you know, and Lud should be given the credit, really.
Wow.
You know, I don't know if Joe would have even brought Arnold over if it wasn't for Lud. You know, that's speculation. I don't know. But I know that Lud was largely responsible.
Wow.
And Lud was, by the way, Lud was a champion bodybuilder himself. Just like, you know, there's a lot of people that complain about, you know, the bodybuilding judges. You might have heard this. I'm sure you competed many times. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say don't like the fact that some of the judges never competed themselves.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem right. Now, it seems like bodybuilders should be judging bodybuilders because they know what to look for. And I understand right. that type of thinking. But on this panel, as you mentioned, you had people that actually trained. Leroy Corporate was a top bodybuilder. Ludd was a champion bodybuilder. Julie trained himself, Julie Levine. Tom Minicello wasn't an active bodybuilder, but he did train. He knew a lot about bodybuilding. So you had a pretty, I would say quite an experienced panel there. You know.
And then the last one was Dr. Kimon Voyages.
Oh, good friend of mine, Kimon Voyages. I knew him from Mid-City. Kimon Voyages was the archetypical Tom Platz. This is a guy.
Oh, really?
He was very famous for his leg development. You know, he had tremendous legs. He was also a chiropractor. One of the nicest guys he befriended me when I was trained in Mid-City. I was 14 years old when I trained in Mid-City. He was always friendly and nice to me. Just a wonderful, wonderful guy. And, you know, an interesting fact is, you remember Steve Reeves, of course.
Mm-hmm,
you saw how great Steve Reeves' leg development was. I mean, do you remember Steve Reeves' leg?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Kimon Voyages actually beat Steve Reeves for the best legs award at the 1947 Mr. America. That's how great Kimon Voyages' legs were.
Wow.
And here's the really interesting, the fascinating thing. I remember asking Kimon Voyages, I said, how did you get those? Because his legs, they were just just massive, and his calves were good. I said, how did you get those legs? And I remember him telling me, and this is really odd, he told me high rep squats.
Hmm.
And years later, when I interviewed Tom Platz, who was world famous for his legs,
mm-hmm.
I said, Tom, how did you get those legs? He says, high rep squats.
It's amazing. Really?
These two guys never even knew each other. They both had fantastic leg development, and they both got it the same way.
Wow.
How's that for irony, you know?
Yeah, I remember Tom when he was training. He was like a football player, and he was squatting really heavy. But yeah. I remember his legs took on a whole new dimension when he started using heavy weights, but for high reps, like 20 to 50 reps.
Well, my favorite story is Tom sent a picture of himself to Joe Weider. This is the mm-hmm. story. And again, it might be apocryphal. I don't know if this is true. But he supposedly sent a picture of himself to Joe Weider, and he asked, and he said in a letter to Joe, he said, "What can I do to become a great bodybuilder?" So Joe looked at, wrote back, "You need to improve your legs."
No way, really?
I saw the picture. If you look at the picture, he's a kid. He was a young guy, Tom, in the photo, and he had a fairly decent upper body. But sure enough, he had no leg development. It's odd to say this about Tom Platz. Yeah. He had no legs.
Is that the picture where he's doing like a side chest?
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember that picture, yeah.
Say no legs, but nothing like that
right.
later
nothing
on.
Nothing.
You know?
Like you would never think you would be able to develop legs like he eventually did.
There you go, exactly, exactly, right. Right.
Wow. Do you remember this Miss Americana contest they had with
I
that
sure
show,
do.
Jerry?
I do, yeah. That was an early bikini contest. And these women look like, the best way to describe them, they look like Playboy bunnies.
Yeah.
They were very, very shapely women, and they would just come out in high heels and they'd walk around and, none of them ever looked like they lifted. There was no muscle on them.
Right.
But they were extremely feminine looking. Most of them were very sexy. I mean, they look, again, like beach girls. I mean, very shapely, very curvy. Christine. I don't know whether she won one of those, but I know she won a bikini contest at the NABBA contest when Arnold and Frank won their universe over there.
1970.
She won a bikini contest there, but I'm not sure whether she competed. I somehow remember her being at the Brooklyn Academy on stage, but I really don't know. I don't recall that. But, that was kind of, the best way to describe the Miss Americana was more or less titillation for the males in the audience. In other words, the bikinis were small, and it was almost like, here's a break, guys. You saw all this muscle, so now we're going to bring out some pulchritude here. That's the best way to describe it. Very pretty girls, though. Very pretty.
Who did you go to the show with, Jerry? Was it your friends?
I believe, if I remember correctly, I took a subway and went myself.
Oh, really? Okay. Wow.
I mean, I'll tell you a story later. Very interesting happened afterwards. It's kind of funny. I never saw this in the magazines.
Another thing I'm reading here, as I'm reading along, Chuck Sykes came out and did a strongman act, and he was in the Mr. Olympia later that year. So he came out, you know, he's going on stage competing. But before he does that, he comes out and he does a strongman act, which he's blowing up hot water bottles and snapping chains and stuff.
Oh, Chuck Sykes was a, you know, he was, of course, he was a top bodybuilder. And a guy with phenomenal strength. I mean, this guy could do, I don't remember how much, 500 plus in the bench press. And he had a strongman act, just like Bill Pearl. He'd come out with this kind of little lion, what is it, toga? I don't know how what you call those.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he'd bend bars. He'd blow up hot water bottles. I never met Chuck Sykes. I did see him do that stuff. But he had a tremendous physique. I mean, he had really great abdominals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very rugged physique is the best way to describe it.
He was like perfect
word. He was like your man's man type of thing. I mean, he'd go like work in the woods and stuff like that.
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, he was a real classic. Unfortunately, from what I understand, he had bouts of depression, and you know, and it got really so bad that he wound up committing suicide years later. I was very sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
By all accounts, Chuck was a really nice guy, from what I understand. Very nice guy.
That's what I think. Roger Schwab went backstage and talked to him that year, and he said he was a really, really nice guy.
Yeah, like that's what I hear. That's what I hear.
Yeah.
I actually saw him once at Mid City. I was training in the gym, and he came in. He was gonna be in one of the Joe's contests. In fact, I think he won that year. I think it was a Mr. World or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he came in. The gym was looking around, and I don't know, but there's something about him that intimidated me. You know, I mean. He had this, like, very intense look on his face that, you know, I was a kid, you know. I mean, today, I this wouldn't even go in my mind, but as a kid, I looked at him. He had this intense look. I wanted to go up and just shake his hand, but I just didn't because, frankly, I was scared.
Yeah, right.
You know, it turned out that what I didn't know at the time is he would have probably been very nice to me because he was a nice guy. Yeah.
Well, what you mentioned earlier, too, about, you know, you're from the East Coast and you see these bodybuilders from the West Coast. I mean, back then, kids today may not understand this, but this was before the, you know, internet, obviously. And all we ever saw these guys was in the magazine. So when you did see them in person, it was like seeing a movie star.
That's absolutely true. Like you said, there was no internet.
Right.
When you see these guys, it was tremendous excitement. I guess the only thing I can compare it to is I once went to the Academy Awards, actually a friend of mine and I were in downtown LA. And, in fact, it was that same guy, Pete Caputo, my training partner.
Uh-huh.
We happened to be near the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion where the Academy Awards are being held that year. And we decided to just, you know, stand outside and watch the movie stars go in.
Right.
And I remember they had these stands set up for the fans. And, you know, I had their big red carpet where they had the movie stars walking in.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that every time a movie star walked, these fans were just screaming. And I mean, I never saw people so excited. They actually were pushing us off, the bleachers. I mean, we were like 10 feet up. And, you know, they were like, just to see the stars, they were like, you know, pushing us. And you know, they wanted to get a better view.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Pete, I got to get out of here because I'm going to punch somebody in a couple of seconds. I can't take this, I said, you know. But the point is, that level of excitement was the same as young bodybuilders like myself. When we saw these California stars, it was almost the same thing. I mean, it was just, wow, there's Chuck Sykes. There's Larry Scott. Oh, my God, wow. We got really excited, really excited.
All right, now this next event I want to talk about was the Mr. World, and this was the one that Sergio Oliva won, so I want to get your thoughts on how Sergio looked. Now, this, of course, is back in 66, so it wasn't the Sergio that later won the Mr. Olympia, but that had to be amazing to see him, huh?
Right. Well, unfortunately, I have a bad story about Sergio Oliva at that particular contest. You know, Sergio Oliva, I, again, from reading the magazines, I was familiar with him. Mm-hmm. I knew that he was a Cuban immigrant that basically escaped Cuba by being on the Cuban weightlifting team. I believe they had a meet, I can't remember where it was, and he defected, and he wound up in Chicago. He trained with Bob Guida, who, you know, who at the Duncan YMCA in Chicago, and he was in the magazines. He had competed in the AAU, and he had a couple of raw deals in the 65 AAU Mr. America. I don't know, John, you probably would remember better than me. I think he made the top five, or he might have gotten sixth. But he was a phenomenal physique even then, and he lost to a guy named Jerry Daniels, And no disrespect to Jerry Daniels. I mean, I never met the man, but, you know, if you look at photos of him, and I never saw him in person, to be, you know, to full disclosure, never saw him in person, but in the photos he looked kind of like a swimmer with big arms. He didn't even look much like a bodybuilder. He had no leg development at all. And then you have Sergio, and Sergio got a couple of bad breaks in the AU. And this particular show that you're talking about, this was his defection to the IFBB.
Right.
He said, I'm tired of the bad, you know, the bad placings I've gotten in the AAU. He suspected there was some sort of racial thing going on, you know, and I'll leave that to others to debate. But this was his first show. So I knew of the guy. And, you know, he was, again, he was a sensation. He was, everybody was talking about Sergio Oliva. And I managed to get backstage, and there was Sergio Oliva. He was preparing to pump up for this Mr. World appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember he was wearing a butcher's robe that had blood all over it, blood stains all over it.
Wow, really?
Yeah, you know. So I went up to him. Again, I was 16 years old. I went up to him and I said, Mr. Oliva, can I get your autograph? I was getting everybody's autograph at the show. I was a kid, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if I should say a four-letter word here on the show. His exact response was, get the fuck out of my face.
Wow. God.
And I looked at him, and I know that in a recent show that you did about the NABBA universe, John, where you interviewed Peter McGuff and my good friend Wayne Galash, who I've known for many years, you guys mentioned about, you know, what Sergio did a similar thing at when he competed against Bill Pearl with a young boy.
Yeah, 1971 universe,
Yeah, that seems to be his habit. So, you know, but the point is, getting back to it, I still had a kind of a Brooklyn attitude back then. You know, I would react. You know, that's the way guys in Brooklyn were. We all thought we were tough guys, you know.
Right.
But I looked at this guy, I was about to curse him out, you know. But I looked at all the blood on the robe, and I looked at his face. You know, he wasn't bald back then. He had, I don't know what he was wearing, or where he had hair, but his face looked like it had scars all over it, like he'd been in fights. He reminded me of a pit bull that was, you know, a fighting pit bull with the scars all over the place.
Right.
And I immediately made the snap decision to quietly walk away and not say anything. And here's the funny part of the story was I told this when I met Sergio Oliva Jr. I told him the story, you know, and he laughed. And, you know, now, you know, Sergio Jr. is a good friend. He's, by the way, 360 degrees away, I should add.
He's nothing
like his father. He's a nice guy. Sergio's a wonderful person, friendly to everybody. He's not like his father was.
Right.
And sometimes Sergio, as a joke, will yell across the gym to me at Gold's Gym in Venice. He'll say, hey, Jerry, I say, what, Sergio? He'd say, get the fuck out of my face. it's like a standing joke we have, you know. But as I said to Sergio Jr., and I'll say it here, regardless of his personality, Sergio Oliva was a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was easily won the title that night. I mean, you know, he had that just ridiculously small waist.
Right.
Sergio Jr., I once commented him. I said, you know, Sergio, you have a lot of your father's genetics. He says, yeah, but the one thing I don't have is that tiny waist he had. You know,
is that what he said? Yeah.
Yeah, he said that. And Sergio was just a phenomenal bodybuilder. He was, I mean, to this day, I mean, I still consider him one of the top three greatest of all time. There's no doubt.
Me too.
I didn't really him as a person because 35 years later or something like that, I was writing for Joe. I don't know if you remember, John. Do you remember when they had the celebration? I think it was the 30th anniversary of Mr. Olympia. Mm-hmm. Where Joe brought all the past Mr. Olympias on stage, you know, including Sergio, Arnold was there, all of them. And Sergio had a booth at that show. And I went up to him again. You know, I remember he was selling a statue of himself in that famous, you know, that overhead pose where he brings his arms overhead. That was Sergio's signature pose, you know.
Right.
And he had a statue he was selling of him in that pose. And I went up to him. He was sitting there at a booth. And I said, Sergio, I'm Jerry Brain. I'm working for Joe Weider, and I'm interviewing all the Mr. Olympias who are here, and I'm just getting short comments from them. I said, I'd like to ask you for, you know, just a couple of comments. And he said to me, you work for Joe Weider? I said, yeah. He said, it'll be $10,000. I said, listen, Sergio, I said, you and I both know Joe Weider. You know he's not going to pay $10,000 for any interview. I said, and so then Sergio looked at me, and you know, and I had to laugh. The first time it happened, I got mad. He said to me, "Then get the fuck out of my face."
No
said,
way.
Thirty years later, oh, he had changed. And again, when I told Sergio Jr. the story, he burst out laughing. He almost fell on the floor laughing. And my reaction when it happened was I didn't get, you know, Sergio was much less intimidating by that time. He was much older, and he wasn't as scary looking. So all I did is say, "Okay, Sergio," and I laughed, and I walked away. I didn't get mad at all. You know, I almost expected it, to be honest with you. but you know, the interesting thing was all the other Olympias were willing to give me comments, but because Sergio refused, I wound up not even doing the article because I.
Oh, really? No kidding.
He was a clear winner. I don't know if do you have a list of who he I don't remember who he competed against in that time.
Yeah, it was a lot of looks like a lot of international competitors, and they even said here in the article, they said the Mr. World was for foreign bodybuilders almost exclusively. They said an American is accepted for competition, but unless he has already won many titles in the United States and is recognized as an accomplished physique star, he's not encouraged to compete in this event. So looking in the short class, they had Pedrito Aquintly from the Philippines, John Bianculli from New York.
I remember John Bianculli,
Sidney Burroughs from the Bahamas. Lloyd Durrell from Trinidad. Elliot Gilchrist, I remember him from Grenada.
Oh, Elliot, he was very very stocky, thick body below. Pretty good vascularity for the time. Yeah, I remember him. Yeah.
Jermaine Godbout from Canada.
No, don't remember him.
Kishi Kimura from Japan. Wasn't he in the contest that Arnold competed in where he lost to Zane? The little short Japanese guy?
Possible. The name, it doesn't ring a bell, though.
Sal Quintano from Puerto Rico.
No.
Pharrell Williams from Bermuda. And then the tall class, Tony Carroll from the Bahamas. I remember
him. Tony Carroll, a very good friend of mine. Yeah, nice guy. Knew him for many years. And he passed away, too. But just, again, terrific, terrific person. Great guy. You know, can't say enough about the guy. He was a wonderful person, wonderful person. I could tell you, you know, when I trained at Mid-City, you mentioned a couple of guys from Bermuda. For some strange reason, a lot of those guys could come up to New York and train at Mid-City. And there's one thing I noticed about all these guys in particular. There was one guy whose name might ring a bell to you. Do you remember a guy named Christopher Ford? Ford, I think his name was?
Yeah, with an E, right? Ford with an
yeah,
E.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They would all, you know, come and train it, and they all had the same similar physique. The odd thing is they had very, very broad shoulders and very wide lats, small waists, and kind of mediocre legs. The legs, some of the guys' legs were better than others. None of them had great legs, but their upper body, they always had this extremely wide back and huge lats. I started to notice it. You know, I remember asking Christopher Ford, I said, "What do you guys do? Why do you guys all have such, you know, wide lats and wide shoulder? Is there some sort of trick?" He says, "No, it's just." He said, "We just train, and you know." He couldn't really answer, but I think he was trying to say it was a genetic thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, when you think about it, it was that was his structure.
Right.
These guys had a natural V-shaped structure, where even if they didn't train, they'd have a V-shape.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was the interesting thing.
And then Vic Downs from Canada, he had a great physique, right?
Vic Downs, oh yeah, this is a guy who started really late. I remember he didn't start training until he was something like either in his late 30s or 40 years old.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he started very late, and he had great abs, pretty good upper body, and he I think he won, I don't know whether he won a universe, I know he won at least one major title. But this is a very unusual guy because he started when he was nearly 40 years old, I remember.
Yeah. I think he was in I think Sergio won the Mr. Universe in 67 and when it was in Canada. I remember Vic Downs was in that one, too.
I think Vic Downs might have won the Mr. World.
Okay.
But I'm guessing on that. I don't really know. I know he won one major title.
You remember Dennis Gauthier from Canada?
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do remember him. Nice physique. Pretty well balanced, you know. Yeah, he was good. He was good.
And then Al Keen, he was from the United States, from Massachusetts.
Al Keen was from Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Nice shoulders, nice upper body, a little weak on the legs. Yeah, and good, you know, but a good bodybuilder, though. Good.
And then Winston Roberts was in it.
Winston Roberts, Winston Roberts, of course, went on to become a top IFBB. He passed away not long ago. He was
I know. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a top IFBB judge. In fact, I got to know him, a very, very friendly, nice guy, really nice mm-hmm. guy. He mentored years later as IFBB, I don't know whether he was a head of the IFBB in Canada or something like that,
I know he
was in the upper echelon of IFBB judges. He mentored a young guy in Canada who became a top pro bodybuilder, Paul Dillette.
Yeah, he talked about that. I interviewed him on my podcast. It was only about a month or two before he passed away, and he mentioned that. Yes.
Yeah, Paul Dillette was his, was mentored by Winston, and Paul told me himself a very rather sad story. You might know Paul started his own bodybuilding federation. I think he calls it the WBBF.
Yeah, he's still got it going now. Yeah,
right in Canada, and his first show. He wanted Winston Roberts to be there, either even as a judge or at least a spectator, mm-hmm. Because he had a lot of respect for Winston Roberts. He says that Paul told me that Winston was like a father to him. That's the way he described him.
Wow.
And Winston Roberts refused to go because he felt that would be disloyal to the IFBB.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Paul was very hurt by that. Very hurt
wow.
by that.
Yeah.
And honestly, I mean, I don't like to get involved. This is like between those guys. But I think that, Winston, I don't really believe that, it's hard for me to believe that the IFBB would have been offended if Winston Roberts, attended the show, because of the guy was like a surrogate son to him.
Yeah.
But they say we all have flaws, and that might have been Winston Roberts' flaw. You know, he didn't think it
yeah.
through, I think.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about this Mr. Universe, and that was Dave Draper's big win. He had won America the year before in 65, but then he came back in 66 and he won the Mr. Universe. So what was it like seeing Dave Draper? That had to be one of the guys you looked up to in the magazines. Huh?
Oh, yeah. Dave Draper was I guess the best way to describe Dave, he was Joe Weider's biggest star prior to Arnold.
Right.
I mean, he was on every cover. I mean, he was literally the golden boy of California bodybuilders, despite the fact that he was born in New Jersey.
Yeah.
What Dave did is, in fact, I have a funny story I could tell you about this. With Dave, when he was in New Jersey, he was a kind of a big, kind of almost bloated bodybuilder. He's a big guy, a nice shape, but no definition at all. Then he went to California, and he literally transformed his physique into this kind of rock-hard physique. And he wound up, like, doing some movies. I mean, this is like the pre-Arnold of, He
yeah.
wound up doing this movie called Don't Make Waves.
With Tony Curtis,
And I believe that had a couple, I believe, if I remember correctly, wasn't there a couple other bodybuilders that Chet Yorton was in that, if I remember correctly, had a
yeah.
big part. There's a couple other bodybuilders in that movie.
And Sharon Tate was in that, right?
Yeah,
Dave
did an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies.
Mm-hmm.
He made a movie with Roddy McDowell called Lord Love a Duck. Dave was apparently very popular, and they were talking about him having a show business career. But, the problem there was Dave, just like he had shared one trait with Frank Zane, is that he was very introverted.
Yeah.
And I don't think he liked the spotlight Hollywood puts on somebody.
Right.
Arnold was, of course, we both know, is just the opposite. He loved attention.
Right,
the more attention he got, the more he loved it. Dave was not like that. And I guess he just really didn't want to get into the show business career. But, at the show, Dave was wearing a pair of trunks. Bill Pearl was known for these kind of metallic.
Yeah.
Bill Pearl gave Dave a pair of his special posing trunks, and that's what Dave wore that night when he won
yeah.
the contest.
You're and blue, right?
He was in tremendous shape, and he was a clear winner. And I remember Dave being just as excited as everybody else about Larry Scott coming out. Believe it or not, Dave was also a big bodybuilding fan.
Yeah.
Years later, I got to know Dave, and I could also say Dave and his wife, the two wonderful people, great people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I remember asking Dave, I said, Dave, I always wondered, how did you transform your physique from this kind of thick physique with no vascularity to this ripped, shredded physique with veins on top of veins? How did you do it? And his answer was very terse and to the point. Tuna and water for 5 years. That was his answer.
Wow.
I forgot it. And I thought to myself, my God, living on tuna. The only guy I'd ever heard of who do something similar was a bodybuilder probably most people don't remember. This guy was a guy named Ron Margeson, I think his name was, who competed in California in the late 60s. Chris Dickerson beat him in a Mr. California show. This guy was known as the praying mantis because of this kind of strange pose he did with his hand on his hip. But he looked like he was literally skinless. He had no muscle bulk at all, but every fiber in his body stood out. I mean, he was freakishly muscular, and the story was that he lived on tuna fish and cottage cheese, nothing else.
That's what was his name, Larry?
Ron Margeson.
Margeson. Okay. Yeah. I remember that name, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He wasn't, he never, I don't think he won any top, he used to win a lot of most muscular awards.
Uh-huh.
You know, but he was, if you ever find a photo of him, he was like very shredded, but no muscle bulk at all. I mean, just like, I mean, he looked like a bodybuilder, but he didn't have the, you know, he had like small arms, just very cut, very, very cut.
Yeah, I remember seeing those pictures of Dave when he was, like you said, bulky and stuff. And I always wondered that, too, because he looked so fantastic when he won the Mr. America, Mr. Universe. And I always thought, you know, but I always heard he was an endomorph, too, like and had a very hard time getting cut.
Yeah, he might have been what they call an endomeso.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, he wasn't really fat. You know, he just had his skin, you know, he didn't have the definition. But, he, you know, the muscle underneath was real. I mean, I remember when he did a, I wasn't out here, but he did a TV show. Where, you know, they used to have those sword and sandal Hercules films in the 60s, you know, Steve Reeves, all these guys, Ed Fury. And they had a TV show here in Los Angeles where, you know, Dave was the host of the show.
Oh, yeah.
Come out I think they called him Dave the Gladiator or something. He came out with, you know, those little, those kind of like, I don't know what they call them, almost like short, what is it? Look like a little skirt or something, you know.
Yeah,
And he had literally have a sword and everything, and he'd come out, and I never saw the show, I just remember reading about it. He came out and would host the show where they'd show one of the Hercules movies on like a Saturday morning, and, you know, he was still bulky back then. He had that bulky physique, you know, which he, of course, like I say, he changed his whole physique later on. But I think Dave is a good example of, you know, if you're really strict enough and you're willing and you're really motivated, it's amazing what you could do if you, you know, if you have the willpower. Because if you look at the early photos of Dave, as I said, you can't imagine this guy being ripped and muscular. Mm-hmm. But he did. He got shredded.
What was the crowd reaction to Dave? Because he was such a popular bodybuilder.
Very, very popular. Very second only to Larry Scott.
Yeah.
I mean, he had the blonde hair. I mean, they loved him. Tremendous applause. Extremely popular. Extremely popular. Everybody was in awe of Dave Draper too.
And he looked like a giant compared to the other bodybuilders. He looked like such a big guy. You know, like an Arnold type of physique. You know.
Yeah, I mean, Dave, what was the Dave, like about maybe six foot, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, at least,
But I mean, most of the other guys were only like 5'8", you know, and Dave did kind of tower over them, you know?
Right.
And he was a big guy. I mean, he looked good. I mean, he looked great. I mean, his legs today, I guess, would be considered a little light, you know? I mean, he didn't have like a Tom Platz legs, that type of thing.
Right.
But, you know, his waist was small, his arms, he had tremendous bicep development. I don't think anybody, there was certainly no boos and no complaints when he won that night. I know that.
And Gabe Boudreaux won the short clash. Remember him?
Gabe Boudreaux was a guy originally from New Orleans, came out to California, trained at Vince's gym. And I remember talking at that show backstage when I was gathering those autographs. I went up to Gabe Boudreaux, and I remember him being just a very, very nice guy. Very warm, friendly, super nice guy.
Yeah.
Tremendous physique, shorter guy. No weak points, excellent. He had great pectoral development, great deltoid. He was a Vince's gym guy also, you know.
Oh, was he? Okay.
Yeah, but just I still remember how nice he was. One of the friendliest guys I met that night.
All right, now let's go to the Mr. Olympia. This was the big event of the night. And, again, the earlier years of the Mr. Olympia was very – I think they only had three guys in the 65 and then four guys in 66.
Right.
So they had Chuck Sipes, Sergio, Harold Poole, and Larry Scott. So we talked a little bit about Chuck Sipes, but what was it like to see him on stage and posing?
You mean Chuck Sipes?
Yeah.
Oh, like I say, very rugged physique. He didn't have the V shape. He had thick deltoids, very like slab-like pectorals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he was famous for his heavy bench presses, so, you know, you could see it in his pectorals. They were like slabs of muscle on his chest. Very, very deep abdominals, and he had prominent obliques. He had, which was kind of unusual. He had, you know, but they looked good. In other words, his waist was a little thicker compared to some of the other guys who had the, you know, the very narrow waist. But, you know, but he made up for it by having this extremely deep abdominal development,
yes,
very, very classic, you know, sculptured oblique development. His legs were not skinny, but they weren't cut. They weren't that cut. And he had fairly decent, you know, passable calf, you know, pretty good calf development, you know, and good arm development, very good tricep development, you know, and a good poser, too. Kind of a classical, he did like strongman poses, you know, like a real man pose. He didn't do any kind of poses that could be interpreted as almost feminine, you know.
Right.
You know, some of the guys, they do with their hands, like, you know, he didn't do any of that. His was like, boom, boom, like power poses, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Was it unusual to see guys with good legs back then, Jerry? Because this is way back in the 60s. This is a long time. And I remember competing in the late 70s. And even back then, to have really good leg development was sort of unusual.
It was an exception to the rule, to tell you the truth. I mean, for some reason, the upper body's always overshadowed the legs.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in fact, some of the guys' legs could only be described as just passable. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a lot of guys lacked leg bicep development. I mean, you didn't see what you see today when, you know, some of these pro bodybuilders, when they turn like what's his name, Phil Heath or who's that guy? The guy with the braid. I can't remember his name offhand.
Oh, Kai Greene.
Kai Greene. You know, when they turn to the side, their legs are just, I mean, their leg bicep development is just freakish.
Yeah, it's like a horse.
You didn't see that at all.
Right.
None of the guys had leg biceps like that. Nothing.
Yeah.
There was nothing there. When they turned to the side, there was no leg bicep.
But back then, there was only, you could only do squats, really, right? And had leg extensions and leg curls.
Well, you could always tell the guys who did squats back then, John, because those are the guys that had fairly decent leg development. The guys that didn't do squats, or a lot of guys didn't want to do squats, so they do hack squats. And they do we had the old style leg press where you kind of like lie on your bed where the machine would be vertical, up and down.
Right, vertical leg press, yeah.
Yeah, and that would be their main leg exercises. And, you know, it's not that their legs were bad, but the guys who had the legs where you would look at them and say, hey, that guy has good legs, those were the squatters.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could look at a bodybuilder and tell, without even talking to him, and tell whether he did squats just by the look of it. Because the guys who did squats always had a greater sweep on the outer thigh. They had more inner thigh. They had the teardrop muscle on the bottom, which was hardly seen in the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're correct. It was a really incredible leg development was a rarity in those days.
Right.
Zane stood out because he had, you know, he had complete leg development. Again, not a massive leg bicep or hamstrings like you see today. But he had cuts here top to bottom, from knee all the way to his hips. He had the muscularity, which made his legs look great. And Frank was a squatter.
Mm-hmm.
Frank, you know, was in his early bodybuilding days. In fact, all the way to, you know, you might remember, he liked squats so much, he developed his own squat device, you know. I forgot what he called it, but I think he still sells it to this day.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's on a harness. You put it on your shoulders. And Frank, wanted to do his squats correctly, where you don't bend forward and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And this particular device allows you to do literally textbook-style squats. So, you know, Frank, his legs were, again, the result of his squatting exercise.
Yeah, I remember reading an article where he said that him and Arnold were training together at Gold's in 1971, and he was squatting like 405, keeping up with Arnold, doing the same weight as Arnold was.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Arnold used to like to do front squats, too, which is an exercise I always had difficulty with.
Me, too. Because, I never liked that.
You know, I didn't like the bar would go into my neck. It was I felt like I was choking when I did that.
Yeah.
And even if I laid it across my shoulders, the bar laying on my shoulders, if you used any kind of weight, you know, even with padding, it was just extremely uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I couldn't see the point of it. You know, I said, you know, what is it? What's the big advantage? If you do squats with good form, why would you need front squats?
Right.
You know, so I cut that exercise out after. I just didn't like that exercise.
Yeah, I could never hold the bar up. It was always falling. I could never keep my elbows up.
You know, just a super uncomfortable exercise. I just could never figure it out why people did it, you know.
But Sergio had to be one of the few guys that had good legs back then, huh, in 66?
Yeah, Sergio had great. But remember, Sergio was an Olympic weightlifter, and, you know, he did all those snatches and cleans, you know, where you kind of like, when you do that snatch lift, it's almost, you have to drop down into a squat position
right.
to stand up. And, you know, God knows how many times Sergio did that to train for the, you know, for the Olympic weightlifting competitions.
Mm-hmm.
That's what built his legs up.
Yeah.
So he squatted from day one.
Right.
Sergio used to say that he came from a family of 20 children back in Cuba.
Wow, really?
And he had a brother who made him look like a baby. In other words, his brother was also a lifter, he said, was so phenomenally built that Sergio looked like a little child next to him. And I always wondered about this, why there was never a picture of this guy. Just think about a bigger version of Sergio. It would be mind-boggling. You know. And I asked Sergio Jr. about it. I said, did your father ever mention having an older brother who was just phenomenally muscular? He says he never mentioned it to me. So I think that story was made up by Sergio. I don't think this person ever existed. I've come to the conclusion that it was just something Sergio did to freak people out.
Right. I heard Bill Pearl had a brother also, right, that was bigger than him.
Yeah, Harold. Yeah, Bill Pearl's brother's named Harold, who used to beat the hell out of Bill Pearl when they were growing up, you know. And Harold used to work for Bill Pearl and sometimes would run Bill's gym when it was on Inglewood Boulevard in Los Angeles. I don't recall ever meeting Harold, his brother. But from what I understand, he was a really rough type of guy. You know, one of these guys that if you look at him wrong, he'd punch you in the face. He wasn't anything right. like Bill.
Right, right. You know? But Bill's got to have some great genetics in his family, right? Because he's – how old is he now? He's got to be
– Bill Pearl right now –
87,
and he turns 88 on October 30th. As far as I know, John, he's the second oldest living Mr. America. The oldest one would be a guy named Harry Johnson, who won the title in 1959. The last I heard, Harry Johnson was still alive. He would be something like 95.
Wow.
I don't really know if Harry is still alive, but of course Bill Pearl's very much alive. So he's the second oldest Mr. And God bless both of them. I hope they're still alive. I hope Harry is still alive. I never met the man. I heard he's a really nice guy too, you know, of the stories I heard.
Yeah, Bill's one of the nicest gentlemen I ever met in the bodybuilding world.
Everybody loves Bill Pearl. I mean, you know, he's the just the image of class in bodybuilding is the best way.
Absolutely. Yeah. So how did Sergio look in this lineup, Jerry, in the Mr. Olympia after winning the Mr. World? Did he freak everybody out? Because I always heard that Larry Scott sort of announced his retirement because he saw Sergio. Was Sergio intimidating?
Sergio did freak everybody out. And to tell you the truth, there was some grumbling in the audience. No, you know, the consensus of the people there was that Larry Scott deserved to win because Larry was the king of bodybuilders. He had this aura about him. Nobody questioned his win. But there was a little grumbling at the contest about Sergio's placing. They felt that he should have been, you know, at least third. What did he get, by the way?
It doesn't really say, but it looks like from the way they're listing it, I thought Chuck Sipes was fourth, Sergio was third, Harold Poole was second, and then Larry was the winner.
Okay, maybe he did get third. Okay, that would be about right, but in other words, you know, I would suggest, and again, this is just speculation on my part, I would suggest that because, remember, this was Sergio's first major IFBB competition, and although he was well-known in bodybuilding from his previous AAU participation, this is his first competition, and it's almost like you have to earn your way up.
Yeah.
So, you know, the highest he could have placed in this show, he was against two veterans.
Yeah.
Larry Scott and Harold Poole. I mean, you know, this was the best he could have done at this particular contest. There's no way they were going to give him the title in his very first IFBB contest. I mean, they already gave him the Mr. World that night.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, they're not going to give him the Mr. Olympia, too. So third place for him was almost like a victory. That's the highest he could have gotten, I would suggest.
No, I take it back. I'm looking at muscle memory now, and it says he got fourth. He did get fourth. Chuck Sipes got third.
Okay, all right. That's what I thought. Yeah, that was where the grumbling was. Some people felt that that Sergio should have beaten Chuck Sipes. That was the only contentious issue of that contest. Personally, I still would have given Chuck I would have had, because Chuck was in tremendous peak shape. He didn't have Sergio's genetics, V-shaped, small waist, and all that, but he was in tremendous shape. He was a veteran. He had won the Mr. World, Mr. Universe. You know, I personally, you know, still would have had Chuck there. This was Sergio's first contest, major Olympia. I felt that, you know, fourth place was still pretty good for him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about Harold Poole? Tell me your observations.
Harold Poole I knew very well. I knew Harold Poole from I met him in Mid-City Gym. He also trained there in New York. You know, Harold, again, was a phenomenon, again, similar to, he had a similar story to Sergio in that he started out in the AAU, got a couple of bad decisions at the 1962 AAU America. He lost to a guy named Joe Benda. Joe, great guy, terrific guy from New York. But, you know, he wasn't up to Sergio's development. Harold Poole. Harold Poole was already ripped even back then. He stood out among all bodybuilders.
Yeah.
He was originally from Indiana. He was one of the greatest teenage athletes in the country. Very few people know that. He was a track star in multiple sports. And then he went into bodybuilding. He already had a physique by the time he went into bodybuilding. He already looked like a bodybuilder.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a natural segue. So he started competing in 1959, I believe. He competed in the AU. Again, you know, I wasn't there, so I couldn't tell you, but, you know, he got a couple of bad breaks. He did win some titles, but when it came to, like, the Mr. America, he was always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
Yeah.
A lot of people say it was because he was a black man, you know, and, again, I'm sure that's possible. I really don't know, but he got sick of it, too, and he went into the IFBB, just like, you know, he wound up winning Mr. America, Mr. Universe in short order, and then, of course, there was the Mr. Olympia. In the first year, I believe, 65, you might need to correct me on this, I think he also got second to Larry Scott.
Yeah, he did.
That was the very first Mr. Olympia. But I knew Harold Poole quite well. He was I was a young kid at Mid-City. I was only 14 years old. Harold was so friendly, so warm. He spoke with a bit of he had a stutter when he spoke. But just the sweetest, nicest guy. I still remember how nice he was to me. There was an incident that I almost hesitate to say this, you know, but I got to say it anyway. At that 1966, remember, I knew Harold Poole. I was a friend of his.
Okay.
I was standing backstage after the contest. I was standing with Harold Poole, I don't know if you remember this guy. There was a guy from New Jersey who was a good friend of Harold Poole. His name was Mike Jubillo. This guy was about 6'3", and he had his arms. He used to wear, like, big sweaters. His shoulders, his arms were just gigantic. He was so big that he made Sergio look like a baby.
Wow.
This guy looked like he was rumored to have 23-inch arms, and I'm not kidding.
Wow, no kidding.
This guy was gigantic. I was standing backstage with Mike Jubillo, who I didn't really know very well, but I knew Harold, and we were just standing there. Larry Scott had just beaten Harold at the Olympia, and I was standing there with these two guys. And a kid came up to Harold and asked for an autograph, and Harold readily signed, and the kid said thanks and walked away. Larry Scott saw this, comes up to me, Jubillo, and Harold Poole, bends over, and he sticks his behind out, and says to Harold, "Harold, sign this."
Wow.
And Harold was such a sweet guy that he just laughed. But
yeah.
Mike Jubillo was, again, from New Jersey. He was a tough guy type. He was a bouncer, as a matter of fact. And he started to go towards Larry. He was going to break Larry Scott. No, people don't know this. Larry Scott almost lost his life that night. And I don't think he even knows it himself.
Wow.
But this guy was going to go and beat the shit out of Larry Scott right there. But Harold stopped him. He says, "Don't worry about it. It's okay. Larry's a nice guy. He's just joking around, you know." And he calmed Mike Jubillo down, and nothing happened. But I'll never forget that.
Wow.
And I remember looking at this guy. I don't think a freaking Sherman tank could have stopped this guy, Mike Jubillo. He was just gigantic, and you know, God knows what this. He had these huge hands.
Mm-hmm.
One punch, and that would have been the end of Larry Scott's life. But so Larry Scott had no idea. You know, Larry, I got to know Larry later on, I don't want to give the wrong impression.
Mm-hmm.
Larry was a little bit arrogant in those days. You know, he knew he was the king of bodybuilding.
Right.
You know, when you get to know Larry, he was a very nice guy. You know, I don't want to create the wrong impression. Larry, especially as he got older, he mellowed out more or less, and he's a super nice guy. I mean, I'm so sorry that he passed away, sadly, from the Alzheimer's disease, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was just like, Larry just meant it as a joke. It wasn't meant, you know, to put Harold down. That's the way Larry was in those days, a little bit
right.
of a joker, you know. But that was an incident that happened. But, you know, Harold Poole's physique, I can tell you, was fantastic. He was actually much bigger than Larry. You know, he was muscular. He was harder than Larry. But unfortunately, Larry had the aura. He had the, you know, he had the momentum. Let's say he had already won it the year before, and you know, it was an uphill battle for Harold. You know, and quite frankly, even though you could say I'm not objective, I'll say it anyway. I felt, and I still remember after the contest commenting on this, I felt that it could have gone either way. In other words, if you judged, what I'm trying to say, John, if you judge purely by physique, mm-hmm. I would have, honestly, I mean, again, accuse me of being non-objective, I you know, but I felt that Harold should have won that night because he was in harder shape. He had more body parts. Larry basically had shoulders and arms.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, he had no back development. Larry, you know, Harold had good back development. Harold had much better abs. Mm-hmm. Harold had much better legs. You know, Larry had the shoulder. You know, Harold's shoulders were comparable to Larry's, but Larry had him on the arms. But you know, it was Larry's aura and I don't know how to put it, his mystique that won the show. I mean, there was just no way anybody on earth could have beaten Larry Scott that night. And then the thing I remember about Larry, you know, I know you're going to ask me about him, but the thing I'll always remember, and I've talked about this with Larry himself, I'll never forget the reception that Larry Scott got when they announced, you know, the other guys had already posed, you know, Sergio and, you know, Chuck and
Chuck.
And here's and Harold. And then, you know, they announced, and from Studio City, California, Larry Scott, and the audience went berserk. Everybody stood on their feet. What I didn't know was there was a young Lou Ferrigno in the audience, too, that night. He told me later on. Everybody stood on their feet and was screaming and yelling. And, you know, 5 minutes go by, 8 minutes go by, and we're all still screaming, Larry,
no
Larry,
way.
Larry. And there's no Larry. After about maybe 12 minutes, suddenly from the left side of the stage, the first glimpse you had was the lights on this platinum blonde hair. It looked platinum, not blonde, platinum. Slowly, step by step, here comes Larry Scott. As soon as he appeared, it was like pandemonium. I mean, the screaming went on. And if I remember correctly, it went on throughout his pose. Every pose he did, it reached a crescendo, just screaming. Larry, I mean, it was like, this went on, John, believe it or not, for 20 minutes,
from the time
they announced his name all the way through his posing, 20 minutes. And I remember in a telephone conversation years later with Larry, I said, Larry, you know, one thing I'll never forget was that reception you got at the 66 Olympia.
Right.
I said, do you remember? He says, I sure do remember that. He says, believe me, I was as surprised as everybody else. He says, I couldn't believe in myself. He goes, you know, I mean, it was just absolutely tremendous. And, you know, he posed, I mean, he did all those, you know, his posing routine, the twisting shot. Every time he flexed those famous arms, oh, my God, the audience went absolutely berserk. And, you know, and then, of course, you know, they the rest, they announced him as the winner. Mm-hmm. And that's when he announced his retirement. He went to the to the podium, but you know, the year before, which I wasn't at, they put this kind of crown on his head,
like the margarine crown.
Yeah, and I don't think they did it the second year. I don't remember them putting a crown at the 67.
Because I think they just gave him that plate with the $1,000.
Yeah, they gave him a plate with some fake money on it, if I remember correctly.
Right.
But I remember him telling me that when they put that crown, he said exactly what you just said. He said, I thought I was in a margarine commercial, you know, when he put that silly-looking crown on his head, you know.
So it sounds like he had a bit of a showman in him, like holding off till he came out.
I think that's what he did. You know, I should have asked him about that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'll never forget it. I'm thinking, where is this guy? I mean, like 10 minutes go by before he walked, and he walked so slowly across the stage, every step. I mean, there was a famous bodybuilder in that same show that year. Might have been Rock Stonewall, I think. I can't remember who it was, who had that same thing. It took him like 8 minutes to get from the side of the stage to the posing DS. He walked so slowly. But in his case, the audience got pissed off because he wasn't Larry Scott. See, they'll accept that from Larry Scott, but not from this guy.
Right.
You know, the Brooklyn audience, you know, they didn't hold anything back. They'd be, hey, move your ass! What are you trying to do? Get on the podium! They were yelling out. They were annoyed at this guy. But when Larry Scott did it, they loved it.
Yeah.
It was amazing, you know? I still remember that. It's
very
funny.
I've had so many people on the show, and we talk about the old days, and we talk about how exciting it was, and the atmosphere, and how loud the crowds were, and it's hard to explain it to today's, you know, the younger kids today, because it's just not the same. But it was crazy back then, right?
Oh, nothing comparable today to then. Nothing comparable. But look, you know, I think of it. A lot of it has to do with, again, the fact that there was no internet. There was nothing. There was no YouTube videos. I mean, you know, all we saw was the magazines, and just the sheer excitement of seeing these guys in person was just absolutely incredible to us. And in fact, there was an incident backstage. This is, again, something that never got in the not backstage, but after the show, there was a funny incident that happened. I can tell you that I don't believe this was ever written up in the magazine. What happened was these guys, all of them, you know, were such stars to the fans that after the show, they all gathered at the side of the Brooklyn Academy of Music, the stage door entrance. There must have been about 300 people standing in the street waiting for the bodybuilders to come out through the door. I mean, there's a scene in Pumping Iron where you can see Arnold walking in through that same door where he's carrying that, you know, that painting of him.
Right.
You know, that was, he was going for that same door. That was the same door he's heading
for.
Oh,
really?
That was the stage door entrance. So after the 66 show, there was about 300 fans in the street waiting for the bodybuilders to come out. And I remember, you know, Dave Draper, they mobbed Dave Draper when he came out. Oh, you know, they were all over him. Dave, you know, there was, you know, Dave was a good sport about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, then the California guys got Gabe Boudreaux and, you know, Donald, all these guys came out. And, you know, they all got the same reception. And again, and finally, who comes out? There's Joe Weider comes out with Larry Scott, right? Mm-hmm. And the audience went berserk, and, you know, I was standing there, and I still remember fearing for Larry Scott's life.
Wow.
Because they were literally jumping on him and tearing at his clothes.
Jesus, really? Wow.
And it was hilarious, because Joe Weider was trying to use his body to shield Larry Scott. I mean, imagine, Joe in this suit was like, he had his arms wrapped around Larry Scott, trying to pull him away from these rabid fans. Finally, you know, what they did is Joe Weider, I wish they could have, this would have been a great video. Too bad they didn't have the video. Joe Weider and Larry Scott break off in a run down the street with the fans and hotly in pursuit. I mean, it was hilarious to see. Luckily, nobody got hurt. But I'll never forget that, the sight of seeing Joe Weider and Larry Scott running down the street with all the fans running after him. They didn't want to hurt. They just love Larry Scott.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not that they wanted to hurt him or beat him. No, no.
It was like the Beatles, you know.
I mean, I hate to compare, but Larry Scott was like God to them. These people worshipped him. I remember when Joe was holding on to Larry Scott, I remember one of the fans said, hey, Joe, are your magazines true? And Joe says, oh, yeah, absolutely, every word. And the kid says, you're full of shit, Joe. I still remember that. It was hilarious. That was funny. Those were good times back then, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
And what happened was, by the way, in case you're wondering, Joe flagged a cab, and him and Larry jumped in, and they got away from the van. So nobody was hurt, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, what Joe used to do in those days is, you know, when he paid for the guys from California to come out to compete at the Brooklyn Academy, he'd only give them a one-way ticket, airplane ticket. You know, and he'd give them the ticket back only if the day after the show, he had photograph sessions set up. The photographer was this guy from Canada. I can't remember. Caruso.
Caruso. Yeah.
Would have in Manhattan, near Union Square, they had a studio, and all the bodybuilders had to show up to be photographed the day after the show.
Mm-hmm.
And at that photo session, Joe would hand them their return tickets. This was to ensure that they showed up with the photos.
Right.
You know, so, you know, Larry Scott, all of them, there was no exceptions to the rule. They all had to show up for the photos to get their return tickets.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
And those were the good old days, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You just don't see that kind of fan craziness, you know, for the bodybuilders anymore.
Oh, boy, I tell you. Like I say, I've attended, you know, I mean, I don't attend the big shows anymore. you know, I don't write for any magazines. I just have my newsletter, and, you know, I don't, sometimes I'll go as a fan, like I did it back, you know, a couple of years ago, and just as, well, not as a fan, as, you know, because I know a lot of, I go to see old friends who I know are going to be there, that, you know, and I do go, you know, I watch the show, but I mean, I don't see the response. It's nothing, nothing, nothing. It's not that the fans aren't enthusiastic, don't get me wrong, but it's nothing like it was back in the old, there was nothing like the Brooklyn Academy days. It was a whole different world. And again, I attribute this to the widespread appearance. I mean, the bodybuilders, I mean, Phil Heath has got dozens of videos. They all have videos, and they're all, you know, I mean, the magazines are dying out, but these guys are all over the Internet. So, you know, it's not the same level of excitement back then as it was back then.
Yeah, it's a different world. And, you know, I was lucky to attend some of those Mr. Olympias in Columbus, Ohio, the late 70s, and it was a similar reaction. The crowd was just so crazy. I remember when Ed Corney posed in 1977. I think he got two or three standing ovations that night. It was just, you don't still see the same kind of level of craziness from the fans as we did before.
Oh, yeah. And you know, and it happened. It wasn't just the Brooklyn Academy. I remember even at those, Ed Jubenville's Mount Holyoke shows, it was at an outdoor amusement center.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have as many, the fans were just enthusiastic. They'd go crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a real level of enthusiasm that again, I haven't seen in years.
Yeah, you could see it in the movie Pumping Iron, you know, when
you could see it. Yeah, look at the crowd in that movie. You'll see.
When
Mike Katz was
exposing, and
the director wasn't. He didn't have an applause sign held out. They were. That was real.
Right.
Those.
One of my favorite scenes in Pumping Iron is when Arnold does that posing at the beginning, where he's guest posing, and as soon as he steps off the stage, the George Butler, the director, was so smart because he takes the camera and he points it towards the audience, and you could almost sense the energy coming out of the audience. From the people were just so pumped up, you know. And I remember those days. I remember being around and seeing some of those shows, and that was the kind of feeling you had, you know, when you saw these guys live.
Oh, absolutely. I still remember it myself.
Yeah.
I can confirm exactly what you just said. I used to get that way myself. I mean, I remember just when I joined Mid-City Gym, the first day I got to the gym, I'm sitting on a bench. And who walks in? I don't know if you remember this guy. There was a famous shorter bodybuilder back then. We're talking about the mid-60s, a guy named Freddie Ortiz.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, he was known for his upper body, and his arms were tremendous. In fact, Arnold told me later on that Freddie Ortiz, and he never said this publicly, he told me that Freddie Ortiz had better arms than him. I never heard Arnold say that about anybody else.
Wow.
That kind of shocked me, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, Freddie, and I remember my mouth dropped. I said, holy Toledo, that's Freddie Ortiz, I said to myself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I remember he had this, again, he had this kind of intimidating look about him, that made me, you know, again, being a kid, I just didn't go up to him. But then about 10 minutes later, who walks in but Harold Poole. This is the first time I met Harold Poole. And Harold Poole had a smile on his face, just seemed like a relaxed. I went right up to him, and he was friendly to me again. Right from the minute I started talking to him, this super nice guy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I told him, hey, Harold, I said, I've seen you in the magazines. I said, oh, my God. I said, you're so great. I said, I am glad. And he was just very nice. He was, you know, not arrogant, nothing. I mean, you know, he was almost shy. I mean, you know, he said, well, I thank you. I really appreciate it and this and that. Mm-hmm. And then I got friends. I was friends with him all the way, you know, the whole time for years. You know, of course, then Harold moved later on. I didn't see him for many, many years, and he passed away. I unfortunately haven't seen Harold in God knows how many years before he passed away, but always a nice guy. And like I say, Larry Scott himself turned out to be a really nice guy. I mean, he was a little arrogant when he was the top king of the bodybuilders, but later on, you know, after he retired, he kind of mellowed out a little bit, and he became his real self came out, let's put it that way, and a very nice man, very nice guy.
Yeah, I know what you mean about being intimidated. I remember when I was a teenager, remember Lance Dreher, the big,
sure.
He had the huge arms? Yeah. Well, he was from Chicago, and he was from the same area I was in, and one of the guys from the gym, he was an older guy, he knew Lance real good, and Lance was at some gym signing autographs or posters or something, and I went up there to see him, and I went up to the table, and my friend goes, hey, this is John from the gym. He goes, this is Lance Dreher. I just was like, I couldn't say anything. And they both started laughing at me, you know, because I was just so intimidated, you know, because you see this guy in person.
I mean,
and it's like, wow.
I know the feeling. I mean, I like I say, I did it myself with a couple of guys, Chuck Sipes, Freddie Ortiz. I remember there was another guy, well, Bob Guider, who I mentioned earlier, who won the 66 Miss AU America, you know, who kind of, I don't know if you call him a mentor. He was a friend of Sergio. They trained at the Duncan YMCA in Chicago.
Yeah.
He walked into Mid-City Gym that same year. He won the same year he won the America. He walked in with a bunch of guys, I remember, and he had that same look about him. He had this kind of, you know, he had all, like a scowl on his face, you know, and you know, and I recognized him immediately. I saw, oh, there's the guy who just won Mr. America. I mean, I wanted to go up and congratulate him, but you know, again, as a kid, it's funny how you react differently when you're a young kid than compared to when you're an adult. See, today I would just, well, I don't care what the guy looks like.
Right.
I want to talk to him. I'll walk up to him, you know.
Right.
But
right.
Back then, I was intimidated. I mean, it looked like a bunch of Chicago gangsters walking in there, you know. So I
right.
said, well, no, I'm not saying nothing to this guy. But I recognized him immediately. He just walked in. He didn't work out. He just looked around the gym and walked out.
Yeah. Hey, one thing I wanted to ask you, Jerry, before we end our conversation is, when you were talking about Harold Poole and you thought he had a better physique overall than Larry, did they do any kind of mandatory poses back then, or did they just come out and pose and then that was pretty much it?
I think they did I don't remember them doing mandatory poses.
Mm-hmm.
In fact,
yeah, because way back then, I don't think they probably would.
The only thing I can remember, I remember them all standing on stage together, you know, but I don't remember them doing mandatory. They stood on stage and then they came out and posed individually.
Yeah.
I don't remember any mandatory poses. I honestly don't. Remember, I don't even know if there was a prejudging. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know that I only attended the night show, so I couldn't if there was a prejudging, they might have had mandatory poses then, but I didn't attend the prejudging, so I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know when Arnold was winning the Mr. Olympia in the 70s, they did have the mandatory poses back then, of course. But I remember even some of those shows, they would have the prejudging at gyms, or they weren't at the same auditorium as where the show was, you know?
I remember a prejudging of a Miss Olympia once that was held at a gym.
Yeah.
I think it was in Chicago, if I remember correctly.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was held at a gym. It was kind of weird, you know. I was covering the show for Joe, so I went to the gym, you know.
Yeah. All right, Jerry. Well, thanks again for coming on the podcast. I really love this interview. You had some really, really great stories, and I hope you could come back and join us again when we start talking about some of the old days.
Sure.
And I just want to mention to everybody again, it's appliedmetabolics.com. It's a fantastic newsletter that Jerry puts out every month. And for the money, it's more information than you could ever imagine. And it's a really great deal. So I hope you're doing good with that, Jerry. And I just want to thank you again for coming on. You got some great stories, and I really enjoyed this interview.
Sure. It was great talking to you. And I always enjoyed taking these trips down memory lane, like they say. It kind of brings back some really good and happy memories for me. So I enjoy it also.
All right, Jerry. Well, we hope to have you back on again. Thanks again.
Sure, John. Take care.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.
All right, thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank Jerry Branum for joining us. I really enjoyed that interview. It was a lot of fun. And next week, we will be joined again by Roger Schwab. And Roger is going to talk about his experience at the 1966 Mr. Olympia. He was at both the 65 and 66. So we're going to get Roger's viewpoint on the 1966 Mr. Olympia as well. So join us next week for that. I want to thank our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Have a great week, everybody. See you next week. Take care.